these guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you've got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Hey, welcome to Tuesday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here on this, it's a sunny day in Chicago. On the phone line is Steve Alexander, who covers business today as well. Orion has the day off. We're going to catch up with John Najarian with any luck in a minute or two. Mm-hmm. You were talking about the speech, and all morning long I was looking, doing business stories, and that Wall Street was kind of waiting to hear some news from President Trump.
Correct.
When it comes to trade. And it doesn't sound like he said anything that's going to really impact the needle one way or another.
It doesn't look like he said anything new. He certainly mentioned China, and that was what traders were waiting for. It was some kind of indication how the Chinese trade talks have been going or are going, because there certainly have been some starts and stops in that over the many months.
Why do we even talk about China trade anymore? I'm kind of serious. What's the point of this? Because
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. I'm confused. Confused as well, because the Wall Street seems to continue to price it in or price it out, whatever the case may be, as to whether there's going to be a deal made. And he is very good at leading us along and giving us these teases that we've got phase one is done. We heard about a month or so ago,
and now we don't know where we're going to sign phase one, let alone what's in phase one.
Exactly. So. Keep in mind, there's an election coming up, and it would probably benefit him to have this happen, if there is a deal to be made, to happen closer to the election than this far out.
Steve Alexander's watching that. I appreciate that, and keep us updated through the show, Steve-O.
Sure.
John Najarian's on a phone line as well. You just saw him on the halftime report on CNBC. John, we were talking about the president's remarks, and Steve Alexander sort of broke down the China trade, where he was blaming U.S. leaders more than China. So there was that. But then he also was toying with the idea of that naming Jerome Powell as the Fed chairman was one of the mistakes he's made. It was kind of a coy comment. Did you pick up on that?
Yes, sir.
What does that mean?
Several negative things to say about Chairman Powell. That follows a long litany of criticisms the president has had of his hand-picked Fed chair. And he mentioned, of course, that rates around the rest of the world are negative, and yet we're paying, even though they're cheap, from a relative historical standpoint, they're much higher than the rest of the world pays. And he says we should be paying the lowest rates. There was a lot of that going on, my friend.
Yeah, but then as far as anything really advancing the needle when it comes to trade or anything like that, it was kind of a status quo address.
Yes, sir. Okay. It was pretty much, Stephen, like we thought it would be, a chest thumping, hey, this is the greatest economy in the history of the world.
He's got some impressive stock.
He's responsible.
He's got some impressive stock numbers to quote.
He does. He does. His point was, and he quoted this stat, I'm sure you heard. He said, if I would have had cooperation from Fed Chair Powell, I would have been 25% higher in all these numbers, in his estimation, because he said the rapid increase in interest rates that the former president didn't have to deal with. He mentioned time and time again how the other person sitting in his seat had zero interest rates for most of his 8 years in office.
Okay, this is where I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
No, and he said, but look what I did with 8 times they raised rates on me, and look what I've still managed to do.
This is where you put a rosy view of a negative study. There's a UBS survey out of the millionaires. More than half of the world's richest investors see a big market drop in 2020. Are they wrong or are they right?
I think they're wrong, and the reason is that I think rates will be lower for longer, even though we've made this 50 basis point move off of the lows of perhaps 147 on the 10-year to now where we are, I think, 192 today. We were almost 2% last week, but we're at about 192 today. I think that's the upper end. Maybe we could see a squeeze of another 20 bips to the upside, Stephen. But if we've got rates this low, keep in mind that last December rates were over 3%.
Right.
So we've got a lot of room before we get to a a similar situation, and I don't see that coming in 2020, even though the rest of the world seems to be stabilizing. They're not experiencing anywhere near the growth that we are.
All right, John, I got 30 seconds. What are you watching today on Wall Street?
All right. Let's see. Twilio. This is one of those companies that's in a space where maybe somebody like Salesforce goes after them or something. Stock is more than 35% off the highs of the year. It's barely up on the year right now at about $98 a share. So I think the institutional paper that we've seen in there indicates people believe that there could be a deal, and they're putting their money where their mouth is.
John Najarian, watch him on CNBC. Follow him on Twitter, at John Najarian. Great to talk to you again, friend.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, Dean's Foods applied for, filed for bankruptcy today. Maybe milk is a thing of the past. Drones certainly are a thing of the future. How's that for a segue? Kaveh Waddell is on a phone line. He writes for Axios and joins us now to talk a little bit about the future of drone gigs. Kaveh, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what are the jobs? Because obviously I'm too big to ride on a drone. You don't need a pilot for a drone. So what are we looking at here?
Well, there's already a number of jobs. There's thousands of jobs that involve drones, and they go all up and down. There are drone pilots, actually. For now, the government requires that you largely see the drone that you're
right.
flying, and so you need somebody at the controls. But there's people who design the drones. There's people who maintain them and clean them. And there's all sorts of people who deal with integrating them into the companies where they're used. And they're used in a number of industries, from filming and entertainment to marketing. Real estate agents are using them to take exciting videos of properties. They're used a lot in construction and in other industrial areas where you might need to do an inspection, maybe of power lines or an oil rig, and that's someplace that's very hard to send a person. But you could just fire up that small drone, put a high-definition camera on it, and see what's going on.
I know you did a study or you did a look with ZipRecruiter. They gave you some data. Is there a geographical area that dominates? I mean, do we break down by geography anything when it comes to drone jobs so far?
Well, this is what I think is really interesting. Unlike traditional tech jobs that you might imagine are concentrated in places like San Francisco, where I live, Seattle, Austin, New York, these jobs are a little bit distributed across big population centers. So if you look at this data and on Axios, you can actually scroll through and look at how many jobs have been open in the past year. You see other places that you might not immediately think of for tech jobs, places like Houston, Minneapolis, Atlanta, Charlotte. All sorts of openings there in the hundreds.
And so do we read anything from that other than that drones are just going to be everywhere?
Well, for now, I think it might tell you something about the more distributed nature of this work. Since it is in so many industries, you could see it popping up wherever there are population centers. The big question is whether that'll continue to be the case. I brought up the requirement that you see drones
right.
as you fly them. That probably won't be the case for forever.
Okay, so let's talk about that for just a sec. So what is it, UPS mm-hmm. or CVS or someone? They talk about their drone delivery experiments and what they've been doing. By and large, when they're doing that, they have to be within eyesight of the drone. So it's still very limiting.
Well, UPS actually is one of the few companies
okay.
that has been given permission to go what's called beyond the visual line of sight. And so that's the pilot program that a couple of other companies are also participating in that is helping the FAA figure out how to go about making the new rules.
Eventually they will make up those new rules, right? Eventually you won't have to see the drone that you're flying.
That's the plan. That's what they have said that they mean to do for several years. It's a slow process. One of the things that they want to do first is develop something called remote ID so that every drone is connected to the ID of the person who's flying it. And that's something that they hope will make it a little bit safer so that if somebody is doing something crazy with the drone which you might imagine happens all the time,
right.
You can find out who's doing it, where they're flying it from, and deal with it.
Okay, so and the most fascinating thing, and it's obvious, but I didn't really think of it until I read your piece, is that we're talking about these drone jobs and everything, but once things are fully up and operational, there could just be a drone hub in Smyrna, Georgia, operating operating drones in Chicago and L.A. and San Francisco.
Right, that's right, and especially if drones become increasingly autonomous, which is the direction the technology is going. You might imagine, you know, right now, if you want to drive a car, you get behind the wheel and you turn the steering wheel until you get to where you want to go. When the cars and the drones are autonomous, then essentially you're saying, okay, I'm at point A, take me to point B, and then somebody is going to be monitoring the feeds from the drone as it moves from A to B. And that's not a job that you need a one-to-one relationship between right. pilot and drone. You can have somebody looking over a bank of 15, 20, 25 video feeds and just intervening when something goes wrong. And that's something that you can do from probably just about anywhere in the country or the world.
And so you could be living in your mom's basement running a drone company.
Sure, maybe so.
How far away are we from that?
It's hard to say. There's these regulatory hurdles that still need to be figured out. But the companies, I think, are seeing dollar signs and trying to move quickly. You know, obviously, Amazon has been talking about this for a very long time. And it's interesting to see that some of these delivery companies especially have made more progress overseas, where some of the regulations are not as stringent. Places like the UK have been test beds for companies that still are not able to make those deliveries in the U.S.
Does that work for us?
But hope to soon.
Is that a good thing for us, that they work out the kinks there, or should we be working out the kinks here to be ahead of the game?
Well, if you talk to the folks at the big companies, they're itching to put these drones in the air. But at the same time, this is still relatively early days for the technology in terms of integrating into an airspace that is expected to have a lot of them. So, you know, as a person walking down the street, you might like the idea that somebody has thought long and hard, and the government is preventing people from doing crazy things that would lead to a midair right. Drone burrito delivery crash that would then fall on your head.
Kaveh Waddell writes about the drones, and also you got a piece I want to talk about here, and it's, you know, we talk about fake video and how it's being easier and easier to manipulate, and the sort of the headline of your story, or the crux of it, is that because video might easily be manipulated in the future, we can't believe what we see anymore, that we might start giving the video sort of the same credence as we would a sketch or a drawing. The fact that right now we think if we see video it's real, in the future we might think it's not much different than a drawing my high schooler made.
That's right. It's kind of a funny, counterintuitive way of thinking, and I spoke to a number of philosophers about this. It was interesting to speak with you know, people who were applying you know, the kinds of thinking that we've been doing for thousands of years to a very, very modern problem. But so, yeah, the idea is that
I want students to right now write this down. When their parents say, what are you going to do with the philosophy major, this is what you're going to do.
that's right. It'll be it can be relevant forever. So the idea that these philosophers had is that you know, just like you look at you know, words written down on a piece of paper that you might pick up on a sidewalk, or a sketch that someone sends you, you think, well, this is kind of, you know, we say artist's rendition or something. This
right.
has been filtered completely through the brain of somebody else, and so that's the product that you see. But you look at a photo, and maybe less a photo, but certainly a video, and you think, well, unless they have access to like a Hollywood budget and a green screen and all sorts of fancy technology and time, this is probably more or less what happened. You know, there's still like tricks of the light and angles and framing, but you trust it more. That may not be the case as deepfakes and AI-powered forgeries become easier and easier to make. And so you might start to think of those two things the same way. You might think, well, you know, what is the person thinking, and how much do I trust them not to alter this very much, and maybe you won't be able to at all.
More and more, we are not able to believe what we see.
That's right. And so that's when we end up having to fall back on other signals, like how much you trust the person's reputation, and potentially some technical signals that people are trying to figure out to tie an identity to a piece of media. But, you know, that has some issues in terms of who has access to that technology, who will be able to believe in the future.
Kaveh Waddell writes about that and more at Axios.com. Kaveh, welcome, or thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's 12:37. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Okay, a guy doing some good stuff is in the newsroom or in the studio now. Shelton Banks is the CEO of Rework Training. Shelton, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, tell me your life story.
Yeah, so South Side, jump right into it.
But wait, but you started in living in a multi-generational home.
Yeah.
On the South Side,
yep.
Right? And what did you think your future looked like at the time?
Probably sticking in that same zip code. So yeah. I grew up in the Roseland neighborhood, and I feel like that's common to many people that come from like the South Side of Chicago, that my life would have just revolved in that zip code.
You know, it's hard. I've come upon this several times, but you know, there are many of us who are more fortunate who travel around the area.
Yeah.
And then there are many of us who live here and have never seen the lake.
Yep.
Or have never seen downtown, right? Is that the sort of stuff we're talking about?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, that's what we experience often in our program.
You still do that?
Yep.
You experience that? Really?
The culture shock of this is my first time hopping on the train and going anything north of Sermac Chinatown. I get that often.
Okay, so multi-generational family. You get accepted to Morgan Park Academy, right?
Yep.
Nice high school. And then you quit.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, so family issues. I had a raised in a single parent household after we left my grandparents' house, and my mom needed help paying the bills, and so took on the responsibility of working and having to pay rent early in life.
Did you feel at the time that you were thwarted, that it was never going to be more than that for you?
No, I never felt, you know, like it was hopeless and bleakless.
Okay.
So I always had like I wanted to get out of the zip code. I guess that was the
right.
dream that kept me going.
Okay, so I don't want to spend too much time on your story, but
yeah.
it's a great one. But it will enter into what you're doing for others now, because then you would started working at a bank. You started working here and there, and you were having some success. I'm interested that people you knew would come to you and ask you for recommendations, and at the time you said no.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, I hit this moment in my career where I was doing well for myself. I would post pictures on social media and just kind of traveling and living it up. And, yeah, people would ask me, and I would always have this fear of if I vouch for this person, they would affect my income and probably my
job.
So
it was a selfish thing you're
yeah.
doing. Yeah,
yeah, real selfish.
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't know the answer to that. You go on to work at Sprout Social that we talk about here a lot, and then you interview for the CEO position at Rework Training. You get the job.
Yeah.
Tell me about the job.
Yeah. So, 8-week training program. It started as 9 weeks of actual on the weekend training with the goal of helping people kind of do what I did.
The people did what you did, or the people who you didn't help.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be too hard on you there.
No.
But that's kind of was your motivation, too.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, when I first had the opportunity to take the job, I initially didn't want to take the job.
Why?
I said I was in a nice position, was making nice money for myself, and I thought about those people.
Right.
You know, I said the people that from the zip code that I came from, I would often get the question of, like, hey, can you refer me to the company you work for? And Rework presented itself, and I said, I can actually do something for those people I couldn't help before.
Maybe I'm a little ahead of myself, but what is it that Rework, how does Rework work?
Yeah, so, you know, majority of Chicago full of tech companies, and their biggest question, the biggest thing they're trying to accomplish right now is to find diverse talent, right? And Chicago is full of diverse talent, but their biggest concern is often that they can't find qualified diverse talent.
Right.
And so Rework, we find people that we think are qualified, that have transferable skill sets, some that have hopped around from different jobs and picked up just skills and transferable things. We spent 8 weeks of training them. So we teach them how to ace an interview and how to get past, how to tell their professional story with the goal of getting them a tech job at one of these sales companies.
And you work with the tech companies too, right? So the tech companies are looking to hire the people coming out of your cohorts.
Yeah, the tech companies have been great, actually. So not only do they hire people that come out of the cohorts, they actually come in and teach a lot of the program.
You see people who didn't ride a bus past Cermak or train now getting jobs downtown?
Yeah, and it's awesome. So our average incoming salary, the average candidate makes around $14,000 when they come into our program.
Mm-hmm.
When they leave the program, they make around $45,000 in 8 weeks.
No kidding.
And so,
I mean, that is life altering.
Yeah. And so we get people that first time, you know, they cry and say, like, hey, I got to take my family on a vacation. Or, you know, like me coming from a low-income household, they actually are making double what their household makes. And yeah. So, yes.
Well, and what you stress and what I think is so valuable or important, that, and we do lose track of it, is that we think there's this linear track to success. You go to that nice high school. You go to college. You get interviewed on career day at that college, and then you start and you work your way up.
Yep.
A lot of very talented people didn't make it that way, and other talented people are being wasted because they're not being recognized.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very rigid view of what success looks like often. And so, you know, not only is that, it's been head trash for me, I think my whole career I suffered from imposter syndrome. Even still now, I kind of suffer from it. But, you know, to get to...
I think successful white guys suffer from that, too.
Oh.
Yeah. But so you've got a fundraiser coming up.
We do. Giving Tuesday
after the holiday. And you talk about the social return on investment, SROI.
Yep.
Explain that for me.
Yeah. So we're all about, if somebody's going to make an investment into us, we want to show proof of that's doing something. Right. And so our social return on investment right now, if somebody donates $1, $4 of that goes back into the community as someone's salary. And that's really the angle that we want to take as we think about, what are we doing with people's money? We're actually investing it into those candidates as salary.
You also do classes with LinkedIn, right?
We do.
Explain that for me.
Yep, that's been huge. So LinkedIn, you know, a lot of candidates see LinkedIn as very, they're nervous about LinkedIn. And so LinkedIn has opted to let us come into their doors and actually do workshops to help people spruce up their resume and their LinkedIn profile so they're not as intimidated.
It's called Rework Training. The CEO is Shelton Banks. Where do people find out more information?
Yep, reworktraining.org. So REWRKTRAING.
It was great to meet you. Congratulations.
Thanks
and
so much.
I hope you have great continued success.
Thank you.
It's the Biz Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. All right, this time of the year is all about being around family, loved ones, and enjoying the ones you're with. But this goes out to all those people who are flying solo these days and are fine with it. You might have heard about Alibaba's massive online sale this week, and that event was called Singles Day. People in China celebrated it with a 24-hour sale, similar to Black Friday or Cyber Monday. Of course, you don't have to be single to partake in the sale, and it makes sense because they got a lot of people to shop. No, I mean a stupid amount of people. The company said they sold $38 billion worth of goods in one day. Holy cow. But if you're looking to spend that money elsewhere, there's always the casino. Rivers Casino is planning to expand their Riverboat Casino. They received an official casino license from the state of Illinois, so now they can add 120 more gaming positions for customers. So if you missed out on the Singles Day sale, don't fret. You can use that hard-earned money elsewhere. And always remember, save that change for those penny slots. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:51. We're winding down here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Tuesday afternoon. Amy Guth is in the studio. She is the host of The Daily Gist, the podcast from Crane Chicago Business, which if I subscribed to podcasts, it would be one of the first ones I did.
I thank you.
I'm just a little late to that whole game. I'm on the Mincing Rascals, and I've never heard it.
I hear it all the time.
No, I do. I have listened to it. Okay, so the story broke yesterday about the Chicago Food Depository. And, you know, we're sort of in that cycle where they start to come into the news a little more regularly as we get toward the holidays.
That's right.
People talk about donations and things like that. But they are going to take on this huge new endeavor to where they're going to be creating from scratch, what, 15,000, 17,000 meals a day? That's the goal anyway.
That's the goal, yeah.
Okay.
Because what they're recognizing is that although the recession was technically ended,
right,
there's a lot of people that still didn't quite recover from it. A lot of people lost their savings, lost their homes. You don't just kind of pick up where you left off. So as the boomer population is moving into retirement years, some of that recession damage is not going to be able to be fixed.
So they might have recovered and been able to feed themselves. They didn't recover, and now they're going to need help not only feeding themselves, but even getting out of the house to get the food.
That's right. And so, you know, I talked with both Sarah Zimmerman from Crane's, as well as the CEO of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, Kate Mayer. And, you know, we had a really interesting conversation because it was really about, you know, there's a lot of people you don't realize are suffering from food insecurity,
right.
Who are in fact suffering from food insecurity. So this undertaking is a $50 million facility. They're raising the money for it now. The plans for it, the Crane site has it, and you can see kind of an architect's rendering. It's really beautiful.
Right by where their warehouse is now.
That's right. That's right. It's right across the street, basically. And there's also a really interesting piece of it that is an educational opportunity. There's a 14-week training program. People that have been impacted by, you know, incarceration or other barriers to employment can get some job training there. There's an urban garden. There's nutrition counseling and, you know, training and workshops. There's a lot to it of kind of building community strength, not just here's food, although 17,000 meals, that's quite a lot.
And so they're going to need an army to deliver those meals too, correct? I mean,
that's right. So they're going to work with, like, you know, they already work with a lot of organizations to distribute. And, you know, I didn't realize prior to getting into this story and talking with the CEO and with Sarah Zimmerman about there's only about 33 big food depositories like this and this kind of undertaking in the country. You know, I would imagine, oh, every city has one.
Sure.
They're not as common as we think, especially of that caliber that has this kind of integrated piece that has a farm and all these pieces to it.
Now, the key is this is their plan. Right. They need those. They need us to pony up.
That's right. They do. They are going to, I imagine, do some very.
I think they're going to aim higher than us, Amy. Maybe higher than me. But
I mean, I've got some change at the bottom of my purse. Right. That's about all they can get out of me.
But,
that's all
I got. But they are going to rely on some philanthropy to make this happen, right?
Yeah, I talked with the CEO about that, and she talked about this is we're actively raising this money right now. There's the cost of what the building will be, then they're staffing it, running it. And, you know, a lot of this is going to be volunteer led. They already have a ton of volunteers. So it's a pretty big undertaking. There's also the matter of getting city approval. The plans are going to go in later this week, but all signs point to the city seems very, very on board with this and very supportive. So I don't foresee any changes or issues.
Let's switch gears a little bit. We talked earlier about Allstate angering its agents because they were changing their fee structure. Now it looks like Chrysler Fiat is angering its dealers with something, not something similar, but something similar.
It's similar in the way that, like, here's this, you know, fleet of people that should have really good feelings about a company that suddenly do not, right?
Sure.
And so a lot of dealers are kind of calling shenanigans on Fiat Chrysler, saying, you're doing this thing again where you're making us carry all this extra inventory so you look good.
Right.
Last time you did
this.
They
look good because they say they're moving cars.
Correct.
Okay.
Meanwhile, the dealers say not only is it not quite on the up and up, but you're in fact encouraging really bad behavior because then there's a lot of pressure for us to sell. There's, you know, corners being cut. And, you know, this is a big thing, and a lot of dealers are really super mad about it and pushing back.
Does it might mean dealers will be more motivated to sell us a car?
Well, maybe motivated is too positive a word, but I think pretty clearly the dealers were saying this causes bad behavior. This causes people to rush people out the door with cars. This car causes a lot of not good behavior.
Amy Guth, listen more at The Daily Gist, the podcast from Crane Chicago Business. Thanks for coming by, Amy.
Thanks so much.